Hi, and welcome to Guideposts. I'm your volunteer reader, Sandy Summers. Today, we continue reading the April-May 2026 issue of Guideposts magazine with articles like Our Ever-Present Help, Overcoming Grief. One moment, we were a happy family of six. The next, I was a widower, wondering how my four daughters and I could ever get through our grief. Our Ever-Present Help by Jonathan Pitts, Franklin, Tennessee. I noticed my 11-year-old daughter, Caitlin, slipping into a jacket. "Where are you going, Caitlin?" I said. "Just out. Don't you think it would be a good idea to stay home with your sisters? I'd like us to be together today." Caitlin paused. She had been the easy one since her mother died just a few months earlier. Of my four daughters, I thought she was handling things the best, going about her routine as if her grief were invisible. Now she exploded. "I don't want to be here. This is a sad house. I don't want to be sad." She threw off her coat and ran upstairs. I felt my shoulders sag. I thought going ahead with our move to Tennessee, where I was the new executive pastor at Church of the City, a move my late wife Winter had so looked forward to, would be healing. A new start. But the sadness had followed us here to Franklin. We couldn't evade it. This was a sad house. In truth, as much as I tried to move past my grief, it followed me everywhere I went, and in every relationship that Winter and I had shared. The noblest thing I felt I could do was to absorb my daughter's pain. I wanted to be there for them, but just when I'd think I was doing a good job, their grief would surface and I would be reminded where we were. If only I could help my girls see God's goodness, I thought. Winter and I had been college sweethearts at Drexel University in Philadelphia. I'll never forget catching a glimpse of her one winter morning while walking to class. I had never met her, but there was a beautiful confidence in her stride. She moved like a woman on a mission. That first glimpse developed into a relationship and then marriage. I was a pharmaceutical rep in New Jersey when we were newlyweds. It was tough starting out. I felt a bit purposeless. I'm a type A. I wanted everything to make sense, and I wanted to feel in control. But to be honest, I wasn't happy. "You can do this, Jonathan," Winter would say. "Stop living so much in your head. God has plans for you. Trust." Not long after our first daughter, Elena, was born, I lost my job in a division-wide downsizing. A blessing in disguise. We spent that Christmas in Dallas, Texas, visiting with a pastor relative of Winter's, Dr. Tony Evans. Before I knew it, Dr. Evans had talked Winter into becoming a grant writer for his ministries. Our family moved to Dallas and doors opened for me too. After several God-ordained steps, I became executive director of Dr. Evans' national ministry, The Urban Alternative, in 2012. I am a textbook extrovert, a real people guy. The position was perfect for me, managing a staff of 40 and cultivating a network of donors for the ministry. The Lord blessed us with three more beautiful girls, Caitlin and twins Cameron and Olivia. Watching Winter grow into an amazing mother to our girls was one of the most profound experiences of my life. Then in 2018, the offer came from Church of the City in Franklin, Tennessee. I wasn't sure if it was God's will. I was always a bit unsure about change, but Winter was sure. "This is your calling, Jonathan. You are meant for this." I accepted the job in May. By July, we had bought a house and moved most of our things there. The girls were excited. On the 24th, the Tuesday of my last week of work at the Urban Alternative, I sent the final pages of a book Winter and I had written about marriage to the publisher. On the way home, I picked up dinner for the six of us. Before we began to eat, Winter said she was tired. "I think I'll lie down." The girls and I had dinner while she rested. Before cleaning up, I went into the bedroom to floss my teeth when I noticed Winter sit up, then slump over very awkwardly. She was unconscious and not breathing. "Call 911, I screamed to the girls. I pleaded with God to save her, but my wife's eyes never opened again. Winter had been everything to me during our 15 years of marriage. Her death, the result of a cardiac dysrhythmia, left me stunned. The day before the funeral, I was taking a walk with Elena when she suddenly asked, "Dad, are we still going to Tennessee?" I hadn't even attempted to make that decision. I hadn't even been able to pray about it. The question hung in the air. Finally, Elena gestured with confidence and said, "Mommy was more excited about Tennessee than any of us. She was excited for you and the church. I think we're supposed to go." From the mouths of babes. We headed to Franklin in early August, the week after Winter's funeral. The senior pastor at Church of the City, Darren Whitehead, and I had agreed I wouldn't start work until after Labor Day, but my new community wasn't going to wait to welcome us. When we drove up to the house, the entire front yard was full of families from the church, more than 100 people. They brought dinner and prayed around the exterior of our home as we went in. A small group stayed to help with unpacking. I tried establishing a routine. This was always my fallback, having a plan, staying busy. Breakfast, school drop-offs, church planning meetings, getting to know my team. I didn't share with my girls all the grief I was feeling, the tears that would come at night. I didn't express much to them other than gratitude for their mom and for being their dad. I understood grief to be a process, that the answer was just to keep putting one foot in front of the other. The girls, I thought, would follow my example. 8 months went by in a dull blur. One afternoon, I stopped outside Elena's bedroom as I noticed she was lying quietly in bed with a comforter pulled over her head. "Are you okay?" I asked, though deep down I knew the answer. Silence. Grief felt like a wall between us, a wall I didn't know how to break through. Then Elena whispered, "Dad, I'm having a hard time believing God is real. And if he is real, I'm having a hard time believing he is good." I didn't know how to respond. I feared that sharing my own doubts with Elena would only worsen her uncertainty. Instead, I found myself quoting Philippians 4:8, telling her she should think on whatever is true, right, honorable, pure, lovely, excellent, and praiseworthy. I thought it would help her feel hopeful again and sense God's goodness. Elena didn't say anything, and I had the sinking sense that I'd failed her. I left her room feeling frustrated and angry. Not at her. I was angry that I couldn't solve my daughter's grief, that I couldn't take away their pain. In the hallway to my right, hanging on the wall, was a framed prayer that Winter and I had written for a book we'd co-authored about parenting. The first line read, "Dear God, I release my daughter into your care." I knew the prayer by heart. Still, I felt as if I were seeing the words for the very first time, as if hearing them in Winter's soft voice, "I release." Had I? Had I released my grief to God? Had I surrendered not just my grief, but my daughter's? We each grieved in our own way, yet we were also meant to grieve together as a family, sharing our pain, our doubts, our fears. As I stared at the prayer, I wondered, in all my planning and all my keeping busy, was I the greatest barrier to our healing journey? Had I not allowed God to share my pain, my family's pain? Was I afraid to face our reality? God was big enough to trust with our grief. He was also good enough to see us through it. We needed to let ourselves grieve, separately and together. I found a pen and signed and dated the back of the canvas of the prayer, a way of making my surrender official. I thought about the scriptures on lament, the psalms that speak honestly about pain, the ones in which David asks if God has abandoned him. I went back to Elena's room and sat down. "I'm sorry for not giving you space to share how you feel about losing your mom," I said. "It's okay to ask hard questions and to feel lost. You're not alone. I don't have all the answers to your questions about God, but I know your mom loved us, and she loved God with all her heart. I know that she is in the arms of Jesus." "I forgive you," Elena said. We sat there for the longest time, neither of us saying a word, but it was a healing silence. Over the next months and years, I tried to meet my daughters in their grief. I told Caitlin I understood why she thought our house was sad, empty of the good memories she had of our old house when her mother was alive. Through the grace of God, I learned to give my daughters space to feel and process their grief, and I learned to process my own. And there would be plenty of time and space to process. One daughter seemingly blew up over household rules. I realized she needed assurance that it was okay to feel anger, that she didn't have to put on a front of having it all together. She didn't have to bottle up her feelings. Anger could be really revealing emotion and lead to a step forward. Another daughter had begun spending long stretches in her room. What I at first mistook for independence, I came to understand was pure heartache. I made sure she knew I was always available for her, that we all were, that God was most importantly, and she needed this time alone to reclaim her joy. And she also needed to know I would come in to sit and be with her. No empty words, just presence. I like to remember a night when we were in the depths of it, and I tried to make dinner by heating up a rotisserie chicken in the oven. My mind drifted, and I burned the chicken to a crisp. I felt like a failure. Then I heard the girls giggle, a sound I hadn't heard in a long time. Just that giggle. It meant everything. I smiled and ordered a pizza. It's been almost 8 years now since winter went to heaven. I have processed my grief, even as I've held my girls. God has been gracious. God has been kind. He has shown me that my daughters didn't need me to be a pastor or a problem solver as much as they needed me to be their father, to give them the kind of hope that first sits with them in their sorrow. We've learned to be patient with each other, trusting that God will be faithful to us through the ups and downs of life. His goodness has reached me again and again, and I am grateful. For more on this story, see Family Room. Answered prayers. My son Michael went to dinner and brought me some beautiful flowers. This is the first Mother's Day we have celebrated together in a long time. Praise the Lord. Evelyn. My daughter came through surgery fine. Thank you for your prayers. Sandra. The Lord has blessed me in small but wonderful ways. We are having lovely spring weather in Puget Sound area. The beach is just a walk away. I am blessed with a friend and a senior dog who will walk with me. Lenita. We were badly behind on our bills. God helped us get caught up. Greg. From our readers and website visitors, send your answered prayers to submissions@guideposts.org. I'm Sandy Summers, and you're listening to Guideposts on Sun Sounds of Arizona, a 24-hour reading and information service for people who can't read print due to a disability. In addition to the bi-monthly Guidepost magazine, each week we may be reading some of Guideposts' other daily devotions or inspiring stories from Guideposts online. Spiritual Notebook, My Stubborn Faith. Easter was supposed to be in the spring, wasn't it? By Rick Hamlin, New York, New York. I was humming Now the Green Blade Riseth, my favorite Easter hymn, while riding with my wife, Carol, in a car to JFK International Airport for our flight to South Africa. It was one of those late March days when spring felt inevitable. I have friends who love the colors of fall, but I love the greening of spring, the ever-increasing light. The gardens in our Washington Heights neighborhood in Upper Manhattan were already beginning to shake off winter, and the trees were budding. Soon we'd see the azaleas beginning to bloom. The Easter altar would be crowded with lilies. I cracked open the window to let in some warming spring air and squeezed Carol's hand. "You excited, sweetie?" I said. "I can't wait to see Tim," she said. I nodded. Tim, 24 at the time, was our younger son. Of our two boys, Tim was the seeker. His restless spirit had taken him far and wide. Now he was spending 10 months at an Episcopal monastery east of Cape Town as he contemplated a religious calling. We jumped at his invitation to spend Holy Week at the monastery. He was eager to show us how the monks lived. I'd never been to South Africa. I'd never even been below the equator. I knew a bit about the country and was especially moved by the writings of Archbishop Desmond Tutu and the role he played in bringing an end to apartheid. It was Bishop Tutu who'd invited the Holy Cross Brothers to establish the monastery. On approach to Cape Town, I looked out the window at the landscape below. The terrain was mostly a mix of brown and gray. I guess spring hasn't quite sprung here, I thought. As we deplaned, I could feel a cool breeze. And finally it dawned on me, how dumb was I? It was not spring here, it was fall in the southern hemisphere, where the seasons are the opposite of those in the north. As we settled into our simple room at the monastery, I brooded on this realization and why it hit me so hard. To me, Easter and its season were inextricable, the very resurrection of the earth itself. This was the reason I assumed that the church fathers had placed the holiest days of the ecclesiastical calendar in spring during the season of rebirth, not retreat. Growing up, I loved Easter egg hunts and Easter baskets and my mom's Easter hats, all those traditions that seemed alien to any other time but spring. One day, while Tim and I went for a run, I looked up at the trees. The leaves were turning just as the leaves in Washington Heights would change 6 months from now. "Does it feel strange to celebrate Easter week in fall?" I asked him. Tim grinned. "I'm getting used to it," he said. "I remind myself it's not the weather, but the meaning." "He's right," Carol said later. "Easter doesn't change just because the season does." It is said that we should have a stubborn faith, yet here I was being stubborn about my faith. Does it really matter when Jesus died for our sins and rose from the tomb to conquer death itself? Easter doesn't happen in fall or spring. It happens in our hearts when we are reborn in faith. On Easter morning, we rose in the dark and gathered outside around a flickering fire, warming ourselves as we listened to the readings and prayers. As the sky slowly brightened, we processed into the half-lit church. We stood there for a long while before the priest proclaimed, "Alleluia, the Lord is risen." "Alleluia," we responded, "the Lord is risen." At the very moment, the sun rose, streaming in the windows, filling us with its light. For more on this story, see Family Room. New Beginnings, Taming the Tongue. How Could I Stop My Terrible Habit of Cursing? By Jessica Reed, Walton, New York. It was bad enough that I was late for a church potluck two summers ago in my small upstate town of Walton, New York, and it was bad enough that I'd shown up empty-handed, having forgotten to bring my homemade mushroom soup, but the absolute worst came after I opened a crock-pot lid at the food table, causing steam to rush out and burn my arm. I yelped. I slammed the lid down and glanced around to see if anyone had heard me. Pastor Paul's raised eyebrows told me he had definitely overheard, so others must have too. I cringe. Still, my pastor's expression was kind, and he didn't say anything. At least my daughter Willow and son River weren't there to witness my unseemly outburst. Both were grown and had recently moved away. The last time River visited and caught me swearing a few times, he'd even asked me to stop. I wish it were that easy. With the house empty and nobody around to hear me besides our dachshund Zero, I'd begun to cuss more often, and it now seemed to have become a habit, a terrible habit. I finished filling my plate and took a seat at the table by myself, no longer even hungry. Maybe this disastrous potluck would be a wake-up call. As a writer, I feel that I've been given the gift of words from God. Surely he wasn't pleased with the way I had been sullying this gift. I vowed to tame my tongue. On the way home from church potluck, I stopped at the supermarket to grab some food for Zero. In the pet food aisle, I spied an acquaintance making a beeline for me. I'm generally a shy and reserved person, not much one for small talk. I began inching back slightly as the woman spoke. She inched forward a step and wham, I backed right into a stacked store display. Cans of dog food rained to the floor with a clatter. I yelled more obscene curses. People stopped their shopping to turn and stare. I dropped to my knees, hurriedly picked up the cans, and scrambled to rearrange them in their original pyramid with little success. The other woman tried to help, but I was humiliated and just wanted her to go away. So much for taming my tongue. Driving home, I thought about how much I love this little town in the Catskills. My then husband and I had moved here from New York City more than 25 years ago because we wanted a place where life was slow and peaceful, where our kids could be big fish in a little ponds, and a place where everyone knew your name. The flip side of that, of course, is that everyone knows all your business. The mistakes you make in a small town are much more likely to be remembered than anything that happens in the relative anonymity of a city. Here in Walton, I wanted to be seen as a serious and even-tempered person, someone worthy of respect. People trusted me to babysit their kids and watch their pets. I had even joined the local library board of trustees, a position I deeply care about, but there I was letting loose with public profanity twice in one day. The light turned green, but the drivers in front of me were still sitting there. Obscene language. Green means go, I yelled out, even though the helpless driver couldn't hear me. Foiled again. Unfortunately, cursing in public has become more common these days, but I wanted to stop doing it myself, so why couldn't I? You have no filter, I told myself. It just pops out before you think about it. Was that true, though? Was my mouth my enemy? I thought about it some more. I had managed never to curse during a library board meeting, I realized, or when I was babysitting. Maybe I did have a filter, giving me a split second to change a word before it came spilling out. As soon as I got home, I did a search for a relevant Bible verse and found one that resonated with me. Proverbs 15:4 says, "The soothing tongue is a tree of life, but a perverse tongue crushes the spirit." I couldn't help but notice that there were far more verses on the subject of grace than there were on swearing. If God could extend me grace for my bad habit, then surely I could grant myself a little grace as well. In the meantime, I decided to test the theory that I did indeed have a filter. The next morning when I stubbed my pinky toe, I used that split second to substitute a different phrase. "Great Gatsby," I cried out. With some practice, shocking words became benign, and in some cases, surprisingly funny. Jesus, blah, 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 turned into Jesus saves. Holy, blah, 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 became holy socks or holy guacamole. When I took a little time to think before I spoke, I found out that my standard curse words were replaced by random songs or book titles, food items, or even celebrity names. "The speed limit is 55, Miley Cyrus," I'd yell at an annoying driver, or "chunky peanut butter" when I took a wrong turn. The next time Willow and River visited, they couldn't believe what was coming out of my mouth and wondered what I would say next. Frankly, I wondered what I would say the next time, too. My kids joined in, substituting their own quirky phrases in moments when they might otherwise have let something else fly. I wondered where they learned to cuss. But I suppose the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. Soon we were all howling with laughter. I felt God laughing too at the creative way I was using that gift of words. But old habits die hard, and in the heat of the moment, a curse word will once in a while tumble out. In those instances, I give myself the grace that God and others extend to me. I don't need to be perfect for them to think well of me. I just have to try my best. Great Gatsby, I believe it's working. Generation to generation. Sometimes the best moments are the ones you don't plan. The Sleepover by Jenny Ivy, Cookeville, Tennessee. I'm a planner. It's kind of my thing. And now a special Friday that I'd been planning for weeks was finally here. I stepped outside my hotel in Boulder, Colorado on the bright spring morning. My daughter Meg and 4-year-old granddaughter Josephine would arrive any minute. I'd come to Boulder from my home in Middle Tennessee for a weekend conference, and Meg and Joe had arranged to drive up from their house near Denver to spend the day with me. Meg's husband Andrew stayed home to look after their infant son, so it would just be us girls. Three generations together. I couldn't wait. "I'll pick you up at the hotel at 9, Meg had told me. "Joe and I are so excited. We made a list of everything we want to do with you." Of course, Meg had a list. She was just like me, punctual, organized, a planner. When Meg was a toddler, she'd help me make our to-do list for the day. Playground, library, feeding apples to the neighbor's horses. When we finished writing out the list, Meg would clap her little hands and say, "Be so fun." It always made me smile. My late mother, little Joe's namesake, was the original planner in the family. She'd start prepping for Thanksgiving before Halloween was over. "If you fail to plan, you plan to fail," Mother told me. I raised Meg and her two younger siblings that way, too. Meg pulled up. I got in the car, gave her a hug, and blew a kiss to Joe in the back seat. I looked at their to-do list. "Wow," I said, "we girls are going to have a ball." Boy, did we. We went on a beautiful hike in the Flatirons, ate lunch at a Victorian-style dining hall, and shopped at the town's general store. We checked off everything Meg had planned. She drove me back to my hotel, the Boulderado. "This is a historic landmark," I said. "Come in and see it before you head home." Meg and Joe were wowed by the grand staircase and the stained glass ceiling in the lobby. When we got to my room, Meg threw herself on the bed. "I wish we'd planned one more thing." "What's that?" I asked, wondering what we could have missed. "To spend the night," she said. "Yay, a sleepover," Joe shouted, jumping up and down. Clearly, she hadn't inherited our planning gene. "I'd love more time with you, Mama," Meg said. "I'd love that too, but..." We told Joe all the reasons it wouldn't work. They had no pajamas, no clean clothes for tomorrow, no toothbrushes, the bed was too small for the three of us, and the biggie, Meg, was still nursing the baby. Was there enough breast milk in the freezer to last till she got home? We sound just like Grandma, Meg said. I sat down on the bed next to her. What do you think she would have said to this? You know, said Meg, Grandma would go off script now and then. She did? Sure. Remember when she invited us grandkids for supper but then changed the menu at the last minute? She fixed us waffles topped with blueberry syrup. Then she set up TV trays in the den so we could all watch Wheel of Fortune. Meg looked at me. A sleepover may not be on our to-do list, but so fun, she asked. So fun, I said. Meg called Andrew. He said there was plenty of breast milk. The hotel gave us two complimentary toothbrushes. We bought oversized souvenir t-shirts that served perfectly as nightgowns. The three of us climbed into bed, snug as a bug, and talked and giggled all night. No doubt my mother was cheering us on from heaven. After all, even she knew the best moments come from trusting that God has something better in mind than you could ever have planned. That's all the time we have today for Guidepost. Thank you for listening. My name is Sandy Summers. Stay tuned for more great programming on Sun Sounds.